Okay, so we're diving into this article from the Geopolitical Compass. It's called Seeds of Prejudice. It was just published today, January 7th, 2025, by Raja, and it's all about this complex history of Christian anti-Semitism. We're going to be exploring its origins, how it evolved over time, and what it means for us today in the 21st century. And one thing that really struck me right off the bat reading this was that, you often think of anti-Semitism as this outright hatred, but it seems like it didn't start that way. It's like it was born out of this kind of rivalry, almost like a sibling rivalry.
That's a really interesting way to put it, and I think the article touches on that. Both Christianity and Judaism, they share a common ancestor.
Right, ancient Israelite tradition.
Exactly. And they have many of the same scriptures. And in the beginning, they were both competing for converts, right? In the same kind of cultural space. So there was this tension there.
So it's almost like each of them was trying to prove that they were the chosen one, the favorite child, so to speak.
Right, exactly. And that need for separation, as the article calls it, is really, really crucial to understanding how this prejudice kind of took root and, led to centuries of really difficult history.
So early Christians were looking at scripture and interpreting it in a way that would kind of, I guess, paint Judaism in a negative light almost, to make it seem like one had to be right and therefore the other had to be wrong.
Exactly. And I think a good example of that is, the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE, which was a huge, huge turning point. And for the Jewish people, it was devastating, right? It was the center of their religious life. But the article mentions that Christians saw it completely differently.
They did,
They saw it as proof of Jesus's prophetic powers, which then kind of fueled this idea that, okay, Christianity is, superseding Judaism.
Right, it's replacing it.
Exactly.
It's interesting how the same event can be, interpreted in such opposite ways. And it's really, I mean, this is like what, almost 2,000 years ago, right? But it really makes you think about the power of interpretation,
Absolutely.
especially when it comes to, religious texts that are considered sacred and sort of foundational. So what happened next? Like, how did things progress from there?
Well, this is where we really start to see interpretations get kind of codified into doctrine. The article highlights two key doctrines that emerged. One is the deicide charge,
Geocide.
which is, this really heavy accusation that Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus, which, of course, you can imagine, fueled a lot of resentment and hostility.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the second doctrine was supersessionism.
Supersessionism, which is this idea that Christianity basically completely replaced Judaism as God's chosen people. It's like the old covenant was obsolete, basically. And these two doctrines became like really cornerstones of anti-Semitic thought. And they were used to justify, all kinds of discrimination and persecution for centuries.
It's hard to even grasp how impactful those ideas were. How they could shape history in such a profound way for so long.
Yeah, it's because it essentially stripped Judaism of its legitimacy, right? In the eyes of many Christians. It was like, okay, these people are, not just wrong, they're like enemies of God. They're dangerous. They're the other.
The other. And it wasn't just words, though,
No.
right? This prejudice actually turned into real world violence.
Tragically, yes. And I think a really stark example of that is the Crusades. Starting in 1096, you have all these crusaders. They're fueled by religious fervor. They're heading to the Holy Land, and on the way, they're targeting Jewish communities. There were massacres, there were forced conversions. It was a really dark period.
It's crazy to think that something that started out as a a pilgrimage essentially could turn into, such a horrifying campaign of violence. But I guess it kind of shows, like, when you have, strong religious beliefs and you combine that with, political power and you throw in some social unrest, like, things can get really, really ugly.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember that the Crusades were just the beginning. I mean, throughout the Middle Ages, you had Jews being constantly accused of all sorts of outlandish things, like blood libel, host desecration, or poisoning, you name it.
I mean, we see this pattern throughout history, right? Like, find a scapegoat, blame them for all of society's ills. And in this case, it seems like those seeds of prejudice were planted centuries earlier with those theological interpretations we were talking about.
Yeah,
exactly. And then around the late Middle Ages, things take another kind of disturbing turn.
Okay.
You start to see the rise of what the article calls racialized anti-Semitism.
Okay, racialized. So how is that different from the, from the religious prejudice that we've been discussing so far?
Well, this is where the idea of being Jewish kind of shifted. It went from being purely a religious identity to something that was seen as, like, inherent.
Hmm.
Something that's in your blood.
Wow.
You know, something you can't change, even if you convert to Christianity.
Yeah.
And the article even mentions the Spanish concept of limpieza de sangre, which means purity of blood.
Purity of blood. It's almost like a precursor to, like, modern day racism, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, people actually had to prove that they didn't have Jewish ancestry.
Wow.
To hold certain positions or, you know, be part of certain institutions.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it was a very chilling precursor to, the kind of racial discrimination we see even today.
So we've gone from, like, theological disputes to, like, full-blown racial prejudice. It's a pretty chilling evolution.
It really is. And what's even more unsettling, perhaps, is that, figures that we might consider progressive today weren't immune to these prejudices.
Right.
The article talks about Martin Luther.
Right. The leader of the Reformation.
Exactly. The guy who, challenged the Catholic Church. You wouldn't think he'd be part of the story, right?
No, not at all. It's hard to imagine him holding these views.
Well, initially, he did have relatively moderate views towards Jews.
Okay.
He even hoped that, they would convert to his reformed version of Christianity.
Right, right.
But when that didn't happen, he became incredibly hostile.
Oh, wow.
He wrote some really awful things, calling for the destruction of synagogues and the expulsion of Jews from, Christian lands. It's a reminder that even people who challenge the status quo, they can still harbor these deeply ingrained prejudices.
Yeah, wow. It's, this has been a heavy but incredibly insightful, I think, look at the past. What comes next in our deep dive into Christian anti-Semitism?
Well, next we're going to explore a really fascinating turn of events. Starting in the 17th century, certain Christian groups actually began advocating for the restoration of Jews to Palestine.
Okay.
But as you see, this support wasn't always as benevolent as it might seem.
So we've been talking about, like, centuries of, persecution the Jewish people faced in Europe. But now this idea of a return to Palestine comes into play.
Yeah.
It almost seems like I don't know, a glimmer of hope in all this darkness, wouldn't you say?
It's definitely a shift. But as the article points out, the support wasn't always straightforward. It mentions that in 17th century England, certain Christian groups like the Puritans started advocating for this Jewish return.
Okay, so why were they doing that? What was their reasoning behind that?
Well, they saw it as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Like, they believed that restoring Jews to their ancestral land was a crucial step that would bring about, the second coming of Christ.
So it wasn't really about, like, supporting Jewish people for who they were or their right to a homeland, so much as it was about their own, messianic expectations.
Yeah, exactly. And often this support came with some pretty significant strings attached. Like, many believe that Jews still needed to convert to Christianity.
Even if they were, like, living in a restored Israel.
Right. Even then, they still needed to convert in order to, achieve salvation in their view.
Wow. So even in their support, there was this, like, inherent bias, this assumption that, Christianity held the ultimate truth.
Unfortunately, yeah. It's a reminder that seemingly positive actions can still be rooted in pretty problematic assumptions about other faiths. And this this idea of Jewish restoration eventually leads to a pretty pivotal moment, the Balfour Declaration of 1917.
Right, right. The declaration that expressed support for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Isn't that considered a positive step towards, the eventual creation of Israel?
It is, but it's really crucial to understand the context. As the article highlights, the Balfour Declaration was largely driven by, British strategic interests in the region.
Okay.
It was World War I. They wanted control of the Suez Canal, and they saw a Jewish presence in Palestine as a way to, advance their own geopolitical goals.
So it wasn't entirely altruistic. There was a lot more going on behind the scenes, basically.
Absolutely. And here's another layer of irony. Arthur Balfour himself, the British Foreign Secretary, who actually penned the declaration, he held some pretty anti-Semitic views.
Wow. So you have this declaration that seems like it's, you know, supporting a Jewish homeland, but it's driven by, you know, British imperialism, and it's authored by someone who's prejudiced against Jews. It's that's a lot to process.
It is. It just goes to show how, you know, historical events are rarely black and white.
Yeah.
The Balfour Declaration really set the stage for the rise of what we call Christian Zionism, which is a movement that, you know, we'll see has its own set of complexities.
Okay, let's talk about that. Christian Zionism. It's a term I've heard, but I'm not sure I fully understand it. What are its core beliefs? What are we talking about here?
Well, Christian Zionism essentially sees supporting a Jewish state as a religious imperative. It's like a necessary step, in their view, towards the second coming of Christ. And one of its key theological underpinnings is something called premillennial dispensationalism.
Premillennial dispensationalism. That sounds complicated.
It is a bit, but essentially it divides history into these different periods or dispensations of God's interaction with humanity. And those who believe in this, they think that we're in the final act, you know, before the second coming of Christ. And they believe that the restoration of the Jewish people to Israel is a key part of that final act.
So for them, supporting Israel isn't just like a political stance. It's it's a deeply held religious conviction.
Exactly. And this has a huge impact on how they view, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because if you believe that God ordained the establishment of Israel, then, you know, criticizing Israel or its policies can feel like you're going against God's plan.
Yeah.
Which can be very problematic.
It sounds like it could lead to some pretty problematic viewpoints.
It often does. Christian Zionism can lead to blind support for Israeli policies, regardless of, you know, what impact those policies have on Palestinians.
Right.
It can also fuel this idea of a greater Israel, which is based on certain biblical interpretations that completely ignore, you know, the claims of Palestinians to the land.
So it creates this this strange paradox where a group claiming to support Jewish people might actually be doing harm to another group in the region.
Exactly. And it begs the question, you know, is this really support if it comes at the expense of others' rights and well-being?
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. This has been eye-opening, to say the least. Where do we go from here in our exploration of Christian anti-Semitism?
Well, in our final part, we're going to delve deeper into this paradox of Christian Zionism.
Okay.
And we're going to look at how this movement, while, you know, outwardly supporting the state of Israel, can still perpetuate some really harmful stereotypes about Jewish people. And we'll examine, you know, how all this impacts the ongoing conflict in the region.
So we've covered a lot in this deep dive, haven't we?
Really have.
We've traced, you know, this tangled history of Christian anti-Semitism all the way from its theological roots to its modern expressions.
Yeah.
And now we're grappling with this idea of Christian Zionism, which just seems like a real head scratcher.
It is.
It's like this mix of, you know, support for the state of Israel, but at times it seems like they're holding on to some pretty problematic views about Jewish people.
Yeah. And that's a really crucial point. And the article does a good job of highlighting that. You know, the unsettling thing is that for many Christian Zionists, their support isn't actually rooted in respect for Judaism as a living faith.
Right.
Or for Jewish people as individuals.
Yeah.
It's more about fulfilling, you know, a specific interpretation of biblical prophecy.
Right.
Where the Jewish people and Israel are kind of playing these predetermined roles.
So it's less about like recognizing Jewish agency.
Exactly.
Or their right to self-determination.
Yeah.
And more about fitting them into this like preordained script.
That's a great way to put it. And the article actually quotes this scholar, Robert C. Fuller, who describes this view as, and I'm quoting here, seeing Jews as pawns in God's salvation history. Basically, they're only significant as actors in this larger Christian narrative.
It almost sounds like they're saying, we support you, but only because your existence serves our own religious purposes.
Right. And that's where the real danger lies, I think, because that kind of thinking ultimately denies Jewish people their their full humanity.
Right.
And it reduces them to these like instruments in someone else's theological drama.
Yeah, it almost feels like an echo of like the historical anti-Semitism that we've been talking
yeah.
about, where, you know, Jews were often demonized or marginalized
mm-hmm.
based on how Christians interpreted their role in theology.
It's a disturbing continuity for sure. And it raises this really fundamental question. Can we truly call this support?
Right.
If it strips away an entire group's agency
yeah.
and reduces their existence to serving someone else's religious agenda.
It's a tough question. And it really makes you think about what genuine allyship actually looks like. You know, what does it mean to stand in solidarity with another group in a way that's truly respectful and supportive?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. True allyship requires recognizing the inherent worth and dignity
mm-hmm.
of the other, right? It means respecting their right to self-determination
right.
and supporting their struggles without imposing your own agenda. And as the article points out, in the case of Christian Zionism, this theological framework has some very real-world consequences, especially in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
No, because if you believe that, you know, Israel's existence is divinely ordained and it's like, you know, a prerequisite for the second coming,
yeah.
it's easy to see how that could lead to, you know, an uncritical acceptance of Israeli policies, even those that are harmful to Palestinians.
Absolutely.
So things like, you know, settlement expansion,
yeah.
the occupation of Palestinian territories,
mm-hmm.
human rights violations.
Yeah.
All of that kind of gets a pass because it's seen as part of God's plan.
Exactly. It creates this situation where Palestinian suffering is almost overlooked or even justified as a necessary part of this larger theological narrative.
And the article doesn't shy away from talking about the, you know, current situation in Gaza. It actually uses the word genocide
yeah.
and argues that, you know, Christian Zionist support for Israel is actually contributing to these atrocities.
It's a tragic example, really, of how ideology, even when it's rooted in faith, can blind people to reality.
Right.
When you're so convinced that one side is divinely favored and the other is essentially expendable, it becomes very easy to ignore injustice and suffering.
This has been a challenging,
it has.
But incredibly important journey, I think. We've seen how, you know, centuries of Christian anti-Semitism,
mm-hmm.
often, you know, intertwined with interpretations of religious texts, have shaped the world we live in today. We've unpacked the paradox of Christian Zionism, where support for Israel can exist alongside these deeply problematic views about Jewish people. It's a lot to absorb.
It is. And I think this deep dive was never about easy answers. It was about exploring complexity. And I think it really highlights how crucial it is to engage in critical thinking,
yeah.
to question our assumptions,
mm-hmm.
and to recognize the humanity of all people, regardless of their religion or ethnicity.
And it also underscores the absolute necessity, I think, of interfaith dialogue and understanding, doesn't it?
Without a doubt. If we truly want a more just and peaceful world, we have to be willing to engage across religious divides, to listen to each other's stories, and to challenge those deeply rooted prejudices.
Yeah, that's well said. Well, this deep dive has given you a lot to consider. As you continue to learn about this complex issue, I encourage you to think about the power of interpretation, the dangers of uncritical support, and above all, the importance of recognizing the full humanity of everyone involved. Thanks for listening.